Yesterday we sort of began our survey of worldviews, and we looked at the predominant worldview of the last 250 years, which is modernism. And we opened that up and looked at its features, saw how it rose to dominance, its shape. But we also came to see that towards the end of the 20th century, whilst much of the institutions of modernism, which we could term modernity, whilst they continued, if you like, the fire of modernism, the spirit of modernism, the optimism of modernism waned considerably. And through the second half of the 20th century, a growing disillusionment with modernism was everywhere apparent. So much so that by the end of the last century, we find ourselves in a post-modern era. As enthusiasm for the ideals of modernism waned, many other worldviews or sources of human comfort and inspiration kind of stepped up to the plate somewhat. And we went through very, very briefly a few of those alternatives that presented themselves as alternatives to modernism. But none of them really have proved to take the kind of dominant central place that modernism once had. So there's something of a vacuum that's been created by the disillusionment with the modern project. When I was giving those lectures back in the 90s, I would always say towards the end of that lecture, you know, of course, this disillusionment with modernism, though it's widespread, not everybody is absolutely given up on the project. I said there is a remnant, you know, a hardcore remnant, which you might call sort of bitter enders, who kind of have not given up. And I would always cite one Richard Dawkins as one of these guys who, and a few others, who is still flying the flag for the modern project and all the values and ideals of modernism. Though a rather sad and lonely voice at that time, despite his claim as a scientist and his gift at writing and his position at Oxford and so on. And in some senses, the very stridency of Richard Dawkins was, to my mind, evidence of a certain desperation that and a certain bewildered frustration that after you know some two centuries of total dominance, suddenly you know everyone was running around looking everywhere else for meaning and inspiration, rather than to the modernist elite. And that very clearly comes through with Richard Dawkins. As you move into the 21st century, of course, and postmodernism seems everywhere, and we'll talk more about that this evening, and the whole project seems, the modern project seems more and more to be fading in the past. And around the world we see a resurgence of religion of various types, Hindu nationalism in India, the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, of course, even Japan sort of toying again with the role of the emperor, all sorts of signs of the resurgence of religion, not least, of course, the United States seeming to resist the trend of secularization. you could be forgiven for really saying, well, you know, modernism is dead and gone, pretty much. And with it, that atheist core. Because remember I said that although the modern project didn't sort of put atheism at the front end of what it was doing, at the front end was liberation and enlightenment. At the back end was a commitment to naturalism, or to use a harder word, atheism. But that word was always considered hard, and so was seldom used. Sometimes people would use the word agnosticism or naturalism. And so you could understand why Alistair McGrath in 2004 would publish a book heralding the end of atheism. Seemed a pretty good argument to make. But it proved to be somewhat bad timing, because a couple of years later, we have in all the media around the world heralded a new movement, the new atheists. The new atheists. And suddenly, atheism is back on the charge. And now, unashamedly, atheism. Not agnosticism, not naturalism, but atheism. And so suddenly, you know, it sounds like maybe the obituary was read a little too quickly. And perhaps modernism is not dead and buried. So we have to address ourselves to this new movement and assess its significance and ask whether we can, as Christians, give a response. And that's what we're going to do this morning. What is the new atheism? Well, it's a sort of rather informal movement of people who feel that it is time to reassert the atheist position, really on modernist sort of premises. But it is led by four figures that have come to prominence through their writing. And it was launched really by an American called Sam Harris in 2004. He wrote a book called The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. The End of Faith. A young guy, a philosophy grad, he wrote as an angry young man, frustrated and deeply concerned about religion. And it's an outright attack on religion. He followed this up a couple of years later with Letter to a Christian Nation, which was a short little book addressed very, very directly to the United States and just viciously rebuking them for their religiosity. And then just last year, he put out a book called The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values. But it was his first book, The End of Faith, that sort of launched the new atheism.
What was the subtitle of that?
Terror and the Future of Reason, 2004. And what set this book apart at that point was, of course, its tone. Angry vilification. It might have sort of come and gone, but in 2006, Richard Dawkins joined Sam Harris and published The God Delusion. Now, Sam Harris is pretty much unheard of. He came out of nowhere. Richard Dawkins, as we know, already had a sizable reputation. And he put forward a much more substantive book than Sam Harris's. And The God Delusion has been, well, at least Alice McGrath said, that it's the atheistic equivalent of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. the atheistic equivalent of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. In other words, the apologetic book for the new atheism. But Dawkins, of course, was capitalizing on a platform that he had established through his own work as a scientist, and then holding the Oxford chair for public understanding of science. He'd already come to some fame through his bestseller, The Selfish Gene, way back in 1976. The Selfish Gene, which really articulated the theory of evolution and natural selection in a very convincing and a very sort of clever way. He's a very, very good writer, very sophisticated use of rhetoric, can draw pictures in the mind very, very well. A real proponent of Darwinian evolution, and most of his focus in his early writings was on explicating evolution in terms that lay people could understand. And he wrote many, many books. Blind Watchmaker was another one that drew a lot of attention. Really the equivalent, if you like, in Britain of Carl Sagan in the United States as a sort of proponent of the glories of science and of the comprehensive explanatory power of evolution. Prolific author, but also prolific speaker and a frequent debater, willing to get up there and really contend for these ideas, somewhat strident. His tone not always went down very well, didn't seem very British sometimes. nonetheless, he had already established quite a platform. Then this comes in, and now he moves beyond simply affirming evolution and naturalism to attacking religion, joining Sam Harris. The same year, 2006, on the other side of the pond in the United States, Daniel Dennett publishes Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. He's a professor of the philosophy of mind. A long-standing advocate and proponent of evolution. He had made it his goal to, as a sort of a philosopher of the mind, his goal was to show that evolution can account for consciousness. A pretty bold ambition. In 1992, he had put out Consciousness Explained, which was his argument for how evolution can explain consciousness. That was 92. And then 96, he published Darwin's Dangerous Idea, pointing out the power, a powerful idea of natural selection and how its evolution as an explanatory paradigm can really explain pretty much everything, hence its danger. Nothing can avoid the explanatory power of evolution. And certainly evolution in explaining everything can explain religion itself. And hence his book, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. So Daniel Dennett joins the gang, this gang of three. The following year, the fourth horseman of the new apocalypse, as they've sometimes been referred to, the four horsemen. The fourth fellow, Christopher Hitchens, British-born, but writing in America, publishes God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. You can see how the titles are becoming more and more really focused and making their argument right there in the title. A long-time author, commentator, critic, mostly in the field of politics, a frequent commentator. He had started out very radical, Trotskyite, I believe, in his politics, and then became quite conservative following 9/11. Provocative, passionate communicator. Here he argues that religion is dysfunctional, it's depraved, it's decadent. He really holds no punches. Interestingly enough, he's got a brother who is also somewhat well known as a commentator, who is a evangelical Christian and has written now a book critiquing Christopher's new atheism. So with these folk coming together, most of these books really hit the bestseller list, and particularly Dawkins' book and Hitchens' books are very, very widely read, and of course a lot of other books now coming out. The term New Atheism was coined by Wired magazine in an article by the editor, I believe, called The Church of the Non-Believers, which came out in 2006. And there he identified this movement as bringing something new, and he called it the New Atheism. It has to be said, on top of this publishing blitz, there's been a tremendous amount of publicity given in the media to this new atheism, which has been intriguing to the media and the academic world, because like McGrath, many people, even secularists, sort of saw the waning of modernity. So even in the secular academy, there's been a sort of interest in, oh, what is this all about? But the new media and the internet particularly have been a tremendous tool for advancing these ideas. Blogs, websites, YouTube debates. I mean, it's just all over the web. And a lot of the cohesion to this movement comes through these virtual platforms. They have tried to have little meetings, but those haven't been very successful. But the sort of anonymity of the web has allowed many, many people to join ranks with the new atheists. Well, what's new about the new atheists? What's new about the new atheists? We need to look a little at the background of atheism itself to assess that. Psalm 14, verse 1 says, "The fool in his heart says there is no God." So, you know, the rejection and denial of God is not a new thing. It goes way, way, way back into ancient times. There have always been those. They were considered fools, but they were those who denied the existence of God. They could be termed fools because the overwhelming consensus across every culture was that there must be some deity. And, of course, who that deity was the discussion. But religion is the norm throughout history and in every culture. It's interesting to note that so ubiquitous was religion and the profusion of gods that when Christianity came along and Christians only had one god, that seemed a very impoverished form of religion. So much so that in the Greco-Roman world, it was Christians who were often called atheists because we didn't believe in the pantheon of the Greco-Roman gods. So it was the Christians who, only one God, I mean, you're practically an atheist. So this is the ubiquity of religion. And the atheist then is had to keep very quiet for a long, long time. For a long time until the Enlightenment. And as we noted yesterday, it was at the Enlightenment that we really saw a massive shift in the culture. with the edifice of Christendom sort of collapsing under its own corruption, basically, and being attacked by the ideals of the Enlightenment, the anti-clericism of the French Enlightenment, was not simply a veneration and a turning to reason and science rather than revelation in the church. It wasn't just a turning to reason, but it was also a disgust with the corruption of the church and a total rejection of all that the church stood for, including scripture and the authority of God. And so the French Enlightenment opted to follow the light of reason, and European culture in its post-Enlightenment phase increasingly marginalizing the church. Church seen as authoritarian, superstitious, backward-looking. Science was the new light. And most thinkers moved rapidly in a deist direction. Yes, of course there's a God, because atheism was still something that most people would want to acknowledge. But God certainly can have nothing to do with all this religious nonsense and this church that is so corrupt. And so the deist position was popular because you could still affirm God, but he was a way back, had got things going, and then man had messed it all up. So you could blame everything on man, and God could remain aloof. David Hume comes along and gives skepticism a philosophical validity. And then later, of course, you have giants like Nietzsche, Marx, Darwin, and Freud, who each in their own way sort of paved the future for a secular understanding of life. And the whole of the academy swings from its Christian roots, Cambridge, Oxford, established by believers, very deliberately so, swings, the whole academy swings under the influence of these thinkers, these scholars, to a secular foundation. We do not need the hypothesis of God to go about our business as scholars. The intellectual elites were confident that as they followed the light of reason, the church, religion, all of that would fade away. It would fade away. And of course there was every reason to believe in that, because that seemed to be exactly what was happening. Religion seemed to be declining everywhere. The centers of power, cultural power, were all occupied by secularists. And so you could, in a sense, indulge religion as an anachronism that would eventually go away. Rather like you indulge a child who believes in the tooth fairy. You don't have to really spell it out to this poor child that there isn't a tooth fairy. It'll eventually sort of put two and two together as it grows up. And these beliefs will just disappear of their own accord. And so in the 20th century, sociologists put together, and it became very popular, the secularization thesis. This thesis that as education spreads, as science gains more and more power, as civilization develops and becomes more global, so religion will disappear. It's a relic of the Dark Ages, and no enlightened person would keep it up. And the secularization thesis seemed to be being validated in Europe, where church attendance was year by year dropping, every analysis showed the steady loss of faith. Many intellectuals, therefore, adopted an attitude to religion of benign neglect. Ignore it and it'll go away. Don't demean yourself by actually engaging it as if it was something serious. You don't debate someone on the existence of the tooth fairy. All you're doing is lending it credibility by even engaging with it. You just simply smile and nod and say, well, it's fine if you want to believe that. With a sort of knowing little smile and a nod to the others that are in the know. And after all, hard-nosed atheism had a little bit of a history that was a little awkward, because hard-nosed atheism, which was present post-Enlightenment in the form of materialism, German materialism particularly, and then reappeared through the ideologies of Marxism, and then were applied by force through the coercive power of the state in the Soviet Union, where the church and religion was officially sort of prescribed against and heavily persecuted. Stalinist Soviet Union, Maoist China. This sort of gave atheism a bit of a bad rap in the 20th century, a little too closely associated with awful intolerance of these states. So most intellectuals were happy to follow Bertrand Russell, who said, well, you know, I'm not going to get into an argument about, you know, is there God, isn't there? We just can never know. We can never know. And so he found the position of agnosticism a much happier position to be. That way you avoided having to sort of get into a debate with anyone and demean yourself by debating these religious people. You could live practically as an atheist, assuming for every practical reasons that, well, we can't know there is a God, so we'll live as if there isn't a God. But you don't have to own atheism, which had this bad reputation because of the atrocities in the Eastern Bloc. Religion could be tolerated, therefore, as a sort of private pursuit, an idiosyncratic kind of occupation for certain people, myth that might have a kind of aesthetic role. But as long as it stayed out of the public domain of culture and of education and of science and so on, that was the new sacred square that could not be sullied by religion. Here, science-based knowledge, reason was king. And so many intellectuals adopted an agnosticism and simply tolerated religion with benign neglect. All of this brings us then to what is new about the new atheism. Well, the new atheists recognize that that was a mistake, that benign neglect. Because religion didn't just fade away. Come the end of the 20th century, in fact, the secularization thesis failed. Whilst one could look to places like Europe and still see evidence of it, globally speaking, it was failing. Peter Berger, the American sociologist, was a great advocate of the secularization thesis back in the 60s. And they were all predicting that by the end of the century, religion would be pretty much gone, except for a few little pockets here and there. Well, when we got to the end of the 20th century, he was man enough to stand up and say, you know, we were wrong. Completely wrong. The secularization thesis failed. Religion is everywhere on the rise again. In the United States, some 95% of the population believe there is a God. After a century, you know, of education and secular indoctrination, if you like. Around the world, we see the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. The developing world, religion is still thriving. And China and the former Soviet Union, where religion being so incredibly suppressed, now resurgent. So the new atheism takes a different approach. Benign neglect is not working anymore. Religion is not going to go away on its own accord. So what are the features of this new atheism? Well, the new atheism is unashamedly atheist, and it goes on the attack. It attacks all religion. Religion is not just wrong or untrue or false, but it is dangerous. That's the first key thing. It's not enough to tolerate this as just some myth. It's a dangerous myth. You see, if it's just untrue, lots of people believe things that are untrue and it doesn't really matter. Life goes on. But no, if you believe something that is dangerous, we can't let that go on. Because, to quote Hitchens, religion kills. That's it. Religion kills. So suddenly, you cannot let it go on. Secondly, faith is stupid. Many, as Hitchens and Dawkins point out, many agnostics, people who themselves were not religious, nonetheless gave some kind of positive affirmation of the idea of faith. There seemed to be something vaguely positive about people who believed. I wish I could believe. Well, they will have none of that. Faith is irrational. It's delusional. The very idea of believing something that you don't have evidence for it can no longer be tolerated. The question isn't just what you have faith in, religion, but the very process of faith is now attacked. We must break, therefore, the taboo that somehow faith and religion should be respected. This kind of benign neglect, this sort of polite attitude, well, there are some people who are very religious, so we won't argue about religion around the dining room table because we might offend somebody. So we keep a polite kind of quiet. That taboo against insulting or offending someone by saying something negative about their religion, that taboo has to be broken. And the new atheists break it with glee because they are not afraid to offend. In fact, they want not only to offend the faithful, but they want to persuade those who are sitting on the sidelines, the agnostics. They want to persuade the agnostics that you should no longer tolerate or even respect the religious. Because you are giving respect to an irrational faith. And you are giving respect to belief in ideas that are dangerous. And you can no longer give it respect. It needs not only to be refuted, but it needs to be done away with. And it needs to be scorned. The shift from simply saying, oh, you're wrong, to saying you're stupid is a big shift. It needs to be scorned because it doesn't warrant respect. Because it's a danger and because it's on the rise, there is a need for a counter movement that persuades that this is a problem. Hence, a new feature of this movement is that it is evangelistic. It's out to convert. It wants to convert religious people and to make them atheists, and it specifically wants to convert agnostics who are tolerant of religion and make them atheists who are intolerant. They're not simply describing their beliefs, but they want to challenge your beliefs. They want to change minds and win hearts. Hence, their polemical approach, their use of rhetoric, their use of the new media to try to make an impact. They're not only evangelistic, they can be described as indeed militant. There is a kind of fundamentalistic mindset at work here. And Alistair McGrath has described this as a new secular fundamentalism. They are dogmatic. Yes, they do look to new evidence that they feel makes the case for atheism stronger. But by and large, what is new is not the new evidence, but the new attitude of dogmatism. That God almost certainly does not exist. That evolution is not a theory, it's a fact. Dawkins particularly does try to be fair-minded at points, and even open-minded at other points, surprisingly open-minded. But the strength of his convictions repeatedly come through. And he finds himself becoming polemical and deferring again and again to dogmatic assertion. And so he's sort of very uneven, Dawkins. He sort of at one moment he's trying to be very fair and kind of concede and have a balanced discussion. And then he just gets... And then he'll make this dogmatic assertion because he's just so impassioned by it. It's not enough to see your religion as sort of wrong. One should be ashamed. One should be ashamed to be religious. Ridicule is one of the chief weapons of the new atheism. Now this dogmatism combined with this scornful ridicule has created a bit of a problem for the new atheism, because it's very apparent that they are very dogmatic and scornful. And in our sort of hyper-tolerant pluralistic era, that comes across as unbearably arrogant. And so their writings have not always been well reviewed, even in the secular press. They have not always been well received in the academy, because it's obvious that they are very, very strident. And their arrogance grates. But they persevere in this dogmatic way, because they feel the stakes are so high. And because the stakes are so high, they can be seen to be militant, in fact. They talk about defeating religion. Their vitriol, although they never advocate violence, their vitriol and their ad hominem arguments and their caricaturizing of religion as dangerous all lays the groundwork very, very, I think, deliberately for a shift in attitude to how society should tolerate religion. And given the experience of the 20th century when certain ideologies came to dominance in certain cultures where religion was seen as something that shouldn't be tolerated, this is something that should be really concerning to us. Because there the power of the state was brought to bear. They can be considered militant in another way because they will truck no middle ground. There is no room for agnosticism in the mind of the new atheist. In fact, Richard Dawkins sets out the very first people he attacks in his book, The God Delusion, are the middle grounders. People who sort of feel, well, maybe we can have religion, you know, and sort of naturalism. You know, maybe religion can be a private sort of pursuit that we can, you know, a sort of benign little practice that we indulge. But, you know, we'll concede the public sphere to the naturalist, to the secularist. But just let us have our religion over here. No, that's not good enough. In their mind, we tried that didn't work. That, he would say to the liberal theologian who says, well, you don't understand, Richard, this religion is just sort of in the head. It's not really about the reality out there. It's to inspire us. It's not something that can ever be discussed in terms of history or science or factual reality. This, you're making a category mistake. Religion is of a different... It's a myth. Even for a liberal theology that has bent over backwards to accommodate the new secularism, that's not good enough for Richard Dawkins. Because you're still, in his mind, even though he recognizes that liberal theology is very benign, very passive, doesn't really have any kind of designs on sort of occupying... Any making any impact on the culture, even though he acknowledges that, it still lends credence to more radical forms of religion. So any form of religion is problematic because it lends credence to more radical forms of religion. And so he is particularly scornful of the secularists who are agnostic, but will not affirm an atheism. And he says, you've got to get off the fence. Get off the fence. You can't ignore this question of God. There's far too much evidence that there is no God. And you need to simply own that and stop fudging. Because while you're trying to be nice, dangerous religions are growing all around. So there's no middle ground for the new atheism. They are at war with religion, and they have set their mind to rebut it and to drive it out. Now, the actual arguments used are not particularly new. The actual arguments that are marshaled are not particularly new. They are recycled from the past. And even their stridency isn't all that new. I mean, you can go back to the sort of post-Enlightenment period and find examples of very strident writers who often said very, very nasty things about religion. The questions they raise and the challenges they make are not new, and they're not ones that haven't been dealt with by philosophers and theologians over the last 250 years. They have frequently been rebutted and have been dealt with to varying degrees of satisfaction. They've been discussed for generations. But we have a new tone, a new kind of a movement that is as much ideological as anything. And what seems to be driving this new movement is clearly the failure of the secularization hopes that religion would fade away. But we have to recognize as well that it is not simply the failure of religion to fade away which is driving some of the animus here, but it is also the resurgence of religion back into the sacred, hallowed ground that the naturalist has felt as his own rightful domain. The rise, for instance, in the United States of evangelicalism, which takes the Bible seriously and believes that Christianity is historically true and has a desire to reform society on that basis and is intent on impacting society, getting involved in the public arena, getting involved in the academy. And so we see the rise of philosophers like Plantinga and Wolterstorff, who are clearly Christian and yet working at a high level in the field of philosophy. We see movements like intelligent design in the sciences, in biology of all places, coming in and trying to bring God back into the discussion. And in politics, of course, we see the rise of the religious right in America. So suddenly you see the invasion of the public sphere. How threatening this must feel. Furthermore, moderates like Carl Sagan or Jay Gould and so on, who try to find a both and kind of position. We can have both religion and naturalism. They seem to be losing ground. A liberal theology seemed to be in decline. It was more fundamentalist than evangelical theology that seemed to be growing. All this, of course, was given its sort of aha moment, September 11th, 2001, where every nightmare that a secularist might have about radicalized fundamentalist religious belief that might be dangerous became true. And they watched, like we all did, with horror as we saw just how aberrant extremist religion can get. And Sam Harris makes no bones about beginning with September 11th in his argument, as does Richard Dawkins. This was the catalyst for the new atheism. The previous century, most of the atrocities were secular atrocities, or atrocities committed by a madman. And for most of the 20th century, it was religious forces that seemed to be resisting totalitarianism and seemed to be moderating and calling for civil liberties and for respect of human freedom and so on. So for most of the 20th century, the forces of evil seemed very clearly to be of an atheistic sort. And the forces of good seemed, and resistance to this evil was the people of faith. But now suddenly you had a prime example of the reverse. Now you had people of faith committing terrible atrocities. And so the new atheists have made hay out of this. Of course, they add to this and they catalogue all the other atrocities, which, sadly to say, are there as we look back in history, and especially as we include all faiths, all religions, it's easy to find atrocities and danger. Religion could be tolerated as private comfort as long as it stayed in its place. But now it was threatening our very lives. What's more, this 9/11 moment was followed by the Bush years. Now forgive me if I get a little political here, because I don't want to skew the discussion. And I have my own personal views about this. But it's undoubtedly that worldwide, many people perceived the President of the United States to be in some ways driven by a religious agenda. I don't think that's actually true, not in the way it was caricaturized, but the fact that his election was helped by many evangelical Christians in the United States did not go unnoticed and was highlighted as proof that this man is driven and is, as it were, at the point end of a rise of a religious right. And this religious right was intent on engaging in a global religious conflict. Now, again, this is not what I'm affirming, but public opinion, even within the United States, substantial numbers of people began to put together this idea that somehow, in response to religious extremists of fundamentalist Islam with 9/11, you got another kind of religious extremism arising, which was going to war and sending troops into Iraq and Afghanistan and all over the place. And so throughout Richard's Dawkins' book, he has these little asides. He doesn't make a big deal, but these little asides that he refers to evangelicals in the United States as the sort of evangelical Taliban. The evangelical Taliban. And so the insinuation is that Lord knows what happens if these religious fanatics get into power. And the subtext, although it's not made deliberately clear, is that religion is dangerous, and imagine if the most powerful nation in the earth is taken over by these religious fanatics. So these are the kinds of linkages that are being made, somewhat more subtly by someone like Richard Dawkins, but much more directly by Sam Harris. And of course, once you get onto the internet and the blogging, then, of course, you know, it's utter flagrant kind of fear-mongering that we see. Now, where's this all going to go? How are we doing for time? Where's this all going to go? No, I'm going to take an excursus here, because if I wrap this up now, you're going to say, well, I haven't really dealt with them, have I? I'm just talking about this sort of sociologically. I haven't really dealt with the arguments. All right, we'll just take 2 minutes to deal with the arguments. Because that's all they deserve. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, we'll talk a little bit about the arguments. God almost certainly does not exist. Well, he's not dogmatic, is he? I mean, could be almost in there. Yes, sir?
Since you are taking the answer, would you appreciate some questions?
No. Sorry, my friend. I want to get this out. God almost certainly does not exist. Dawkins actually has a lot of very, very good things to say that we can really latch on to. But his rhetoric is so powerful that we sometimes fail to note that. One of the things he will acknowledge is that it is impossible to disprove the existence of God absolutely. And he acknowledges that you cannot prove a negative. That's why he puts the almost there. He knows intellectually he's on a winning, not on a winning ticket. These books are not written as scholarly works. He tries to maintain his scholarly reputation, however, by throughout the book having serious arguments. And then he indulges populist rhetoric, because these books are aimed at the populace, and the rhetoric is doing the work. But he wants to maintain some degree of credibility, so there are within it some serious arguments. I'm not going to deal with the populist rhetoric. We will come back to that, because that actually is the more tricky thing to deal with. We'll come back to all the arguments about, you know, how Christians behaving badly proves there isn't a God, for instance. And many other arguments like that, which are more anecdotal, rhetorical arguments. But I do want to deal with some of these more serious arguments. And there there's many nuggets that you can easily miss that are very important. Number one, he recognizes that you cannot ultimately and absolutely prove a negative. But what he would say is that the probability of God is so, so unlikely that he almost certainly doesn't exist. So he puts a lot of store in probabilities. In fact, all his whole argument rests on probabilities. He's not looking at ultimate proofs that are slam dunks. He's looking at probabilities. This can work to our advantage. I'll show you. He has essentially three arguments. One, he has an argument against... He has an argument for atheism, and he has an argument against theism, and he has two of those, so 2A and 2B. One argument for atheism and two arguments against theism. The argument for atheism is very, very simple, and he repeats it three or four times, but he never elaborates, because in his mind it is such a slam dunk that you don't have to elaborate. This, of course, is a rhetorical device. But he loves to make the argument in a way that seems a slam dunk. I left the conference stimulated and invigorated and reinforced in my conviction that the argument from improbability is a very serious argument against the existence of God, and one to which I have yet to hear a theologian give a convincing answer, despite numerous opportunities and invitations to do so. Dan Dennett rightly describes it as an unrebuttable refutation. What is this argument from improbability he's referring to? This is his one argument, the only argument he has for atheism. He mentions it three or four times. He doesn't give it more than a paragraph to actually elaborate. What is the argument from improbability? Essentially, this argument is that it's improbable that God exists. Okay, so we're dealing with number one now. It's improbable that God exists. Why is it improbable? Well, because he would say God is a very complex being. He must be complex because he made a very complex universe. And anything that could make a complex universe must be at least more complex than the universe itself. Right? So God, therefore, is a very complex being. But we know that the more complex a thing is, the less likely it is to exist. And so because God is so highly complex, it's extremely unlikely that he exists. You all buy that one? So, complexity. God is complex. Must be, because you have to be more complex than the complex thing you make. And the probability of a complex thing existing, the more complex it is, the more improbable it is. God is very, very complex, therefore he's very, very improbable. Now this is wrong on so many levels. I actually am a little sad to say that I don't think those who have rebutted it have actually really gone to town on it sufficiently. It's central to his arguments. And although Alistair McGrath deals with it, and Plantinga deals with it, I think they could do more with it. The fact of the matter is, as Plantinga points out, it's a category mistake. It's a category mistake. Because how do we evaluate probability? How do we know that a complex thing is more improbable than a less complex thing? Well, we know that only if we know something of how things come to be. And we might say that a round pebble is less complex than a Jaguar or a Mercedes Benz. And therefore, a round pebble coming to be is less unlikely than a Mercedes Benz. But you see, to assess that sort of probabilities and to compare those sorts of probabilities, you have to have a lot of knowledge of the surrounding conditions. You have to have a sense of what produces pebbles, and you have to have a sense of what is needed to produce a Mercedes Benz. And only as you have a sense of those prior conditions can you actually evaluate those probabilities. Now, we can think about something as complex as the universe, or we can think of the complexities of human life, and we know that human life is made out of atoms and so on, and we know some of the natural laws that govern the physical universe, and so we can kind of evaluate the degree of probability that highly complex organisms have come from simple matter working according to simple laws. And we can say, well, that's rather improbable, something that Dawkins acknowledges. But that's only because we have understanding of that surrounding conditions. What do we know about the surrounding conditions in regard to the existence of God? Nothing. Nothing. We have no knowledge of what was before God, or what conditioned God, or how God came into being. We can, by definition, not know that. Because by definition, God is bigger than the universe. He's outside of the universe. Anything within the universe, we can throw around ideas of probability. Some with more accuracy than others. Some is just wild, random guesses. But at least we can guess to the probability of something within the universe. But to guess to the probability of something outside of the universe is impossible. God may be absolutely probable, or he may be completely improbable. We have no way of knowing that. We have nothing against which to assess that. So to say that God is improbable because he's complex is a category mistake. Now, some folk have argued about this issue of complexity and said, well, no, theologically, we believe God is actually simple, not complex. I think that's a mistake to get into that kind of a discussion. I think it's unnecessary. I do believe that God is not complex in the way that Dawkins says he's complex. See, Dawkins is a materialist, and so he's viewing God through materialist eyes. And so he sees God as very, very complex. Theologians are more philosophically or theologically founded in their thinking, and so they view God as a simple being, one substance. But that's not really the debate here. And to get involved in that debate, is God complex or not, is, to my mind, unnecessary. What we need to realize is that we're dealing with a being who by definition is outside of the universe. And because of that, we can know nothing of his prior conditions. And we're not doing anything by sleight of hand. We're not doing anything that the scientists aren't doing themselves. That's what they deal with the Big Bang. When you ask the scientists, what about before the Big Bang? What do they say? They say, well, we can know nothing about that. Well, but what happened? Oh, well, no, we don't admit that question, they will tell you. Because by definition, we can't know what was before time. So we don't have to deal with that. If the secularists can say we don't need to go behind the contingency of the Big Bang, well, then how can Dawkins go behind that and assess a probability to an infinite eternal being existing? Quick question, John.
Just wanted to make sure I'm getting this clear, that the category of a state is another way of putting it in terms of he's talking about created things or
yes.
beings, and God is by definition uncreated.
Exactly. But I wouldn't even necessarily go that way, because there you're talking about the very nature of God is that he is not created. We'll come back to that. I'm just simply saying that we can know nothing about the prior conditions of God.
But presumably Dawkins wouldn't buy this. I mean, well, if he was sitting here...
I don't know. Plantinga has refuted this on the basis of it being a category mistake. But whether or not he's interacted with Dawkins about this, I don't know. But I want to push... I'm going to have to go on, friend. I'm sorry. But the important thing to recognize is that we can only know about God what he tells us. We don't have any way to get behind God. Our use of probability is all premised on understanding of conditions that give rise to something. We usually only use the word probability about events, not about bare existence. And we're talking about the brute, bare existence of God. How can it assign a probability? We normally assign probabilities to event. We could say, what is the probability of God arising out of nothing? Well, you could talk about that, because that's an event, if you like. But if it was there, we could say God doesn't arise out of nothing. He's eternally existed. Let me go on, and we can have some discussion. 2a and 2b. Against theism, he tackles what in his mind are the two strongest arguments for God. The cosmological and the theological argument. The cosmological argument he tackles says that we have something that exists. It must have come from somewhere. Things don't come from nothing. It must have come from a creator, from a God. So God is the explanation for why something exists at all. He rebuts that. Dawkins rebuts that, and he says that's no explanation at all. Why? Well, because you can simply ask, where did God come from? So you have no explanation. So God cannot be explanation for the universe, because God himself begs an explanation. And therefore he dismisses that as an argument. Now, there's two things we can say about that. One is what John just said, which is, well, the question, where did God come from? Who made God? Is answered by God himself, who says that I have eternally existed. I am self-sustaining being. I'm a non-contingent being. But I would want to go before that and say, I think we can respond to this more simply. Who says that we have failed to answer the question, where did the universe come from, by positing God, just because you can ask questions about God? If you ask a scientist, why did that fall? Gravity, my dear boy, gravity. Because you see, mass is attracted to one another, and there's various laws that govern that, and you can explain all that away. And I'd say, well, you haven't explained a thing, because you didn't tell me where gravity came from. Right? Suppose I say to Rob, where do you come from, Rob? And he says, well, I was born in Africa. And I said, well, you haven't explained anything. Where were your parents born? You see, we can always ask another question. But does that mean that we haven't answered anything? So it's true that when we say, where did everything come from? We say, God. It's true that we haven't answered every possible question, but we're not answering every possible question. We're answering the question, where did this come from? Where did the universe come from? And the answer is very simple. The universe came from a creator God. Now you can ask questions about the creator God. Sure. That doesn't invalidate our answer. It just simply raises new questions. That's exactly what happens in science. Every time science answers a question, it raises multiple new ones. And guess what happens? They celebrate that. They said, that's the glory of science. Every time we find out a new thing, it raises more questions for us to explore and get government grants to pursue. It's wonderful. More PhD theses. That's celebrated. But here suddenly, you know, it's a deficiency in our argument. Well, it's not at all. And in fact, the glorious thing is that we do have an answer to who created God. He didn't. No one created God. He is self-existing. He's eternally existing. To be. That was the cosmological. This is the teleological argument.
Can you spell that, please?
Ooh, okay. Cosmo.
I couldn't do Cosmo. I can't do
logical. That's why I'm doing this one first. I'm going to think about the other one. Teleo. Logical. That everything has purpose. Everything out there in the universe seems to have purpose, seems to have design, seems to have been made specifically for a purpose. Therefore, it must have a designer. That's the Christian argument. Why we believe that, partly, one of the arguments for why we believe there's a God. Because something must have made this amazingly sophisticated and purposeful universe. Dawkins admits that there is evidence for teleology everywhere in the universe. He admits that things look designed. Do we have time for excursions? No, no rats. He admits that. He admits a lot of really neat things. I think someone needs to write a book proving the existence of God using direct quotes from Dawkins. You can do it. It's marvelous what he gives away. Anyway, purpose in the universe. He admits, yes, there is design, apparent design, but we have an explanation for it. We don't need to resort to designer. We can talk about a self-designing mechanism called natural selection, evolution. So yeah, he rejects the design theory and he puts in its place the theory of evolution. The idea of postulating a designer, he says, is untenable because we go back to argument one, highly improbable. Instead, we look to an evolutionary mechanism. Now here, interesting enough, he admits there's also lots of improbabilities here. So he says if we explain design in the universe, there's only two possibilities, God or evolution. He admits that this is improbable, but his argument is that God is even more improbable. He admits that a naturalistic explanation for the design is an incredibly difficult thing to find. And he worships Darwin because he believes Darwin found a naturalistic explanation for design. And he has said himself that there is no other hypothesis. Now that's kind of interesting. Because what he's saying is that apart from God, there is only one theory out there to explain design. Now, he would go on to say that the evidence for evolution is so strong that it's a fact, not a hypothesis. But you have to ask yourself something. If that's the only theory you have, even if you had a paltry amount of evidence, where else are you going to go? So what does he mean when he says the evidence is massive for evolution? How can you possibly make that statement unless you have a contending hypothesis and say, well, there's more evidence for this hypothesis than for that hypothesis? Actual fact, there's only one hypothesis on the table. So however little the evidence, it's always going to be enough because you have nowhere else to go. That's something of an aside. Design can only be explained by God or evolution. This, he says, is highly improbable. This, he acknowledges, is also improbable. Why is this improbable? You start with the Big Bang. You move along. And over here, you have consciousness. Human consciousness. Very, very simple, very, very complex. How did we get from there to there? On just natural time and plus chance, natural forces, seems highly improbable. He sets about, therefore, making it more probable that there's a natural, a natural explanation for all of this. That's what he wants to do. He starts with the Big Bang, and he acknowledges that's very, very improbable. Something coming from nothing. But we're here, so it must have happened. Then he goes on to the fine tuning of this universe. And he acknowledges that that is incredibly improbable. And so we have to dream up multiple universes to even make it plausible. Multiple universes for which we have no evidence. Multiple universes which, by definition, must be outside our universe. Which means he's back outside our universe now, where God belongs, filling it with his own entities, multiple universes. But he admits that's all speculation. He admits that this is highly improbable that we have a fine-tuned universe. But we have one, so it must have happened. Then we get the first self. He admits it's highly improbable that the first cell arose out of the swamp. In fact, and he acknowledges that the evolutionary process, the evolutionary mechanism of natural design, doesn't work to produce the first cell. He's very honest about this because evolution needs living things to work. Natural evolution, natural selection selects among living things. Here you have inorganic matter. Chemicals suddenly coming together and forming something that's alive. Highly improbable. He has, and he admits, there is no mechanism that science has come up with to explain how that happened. They have nothing. By analogy, he thinks it's going to be something like evolution, but they have no idea. He admits it's highly improbable. He tries to reduce that improbability by speculating that there are billions and billions of planets out there. And so there have been billions and billions of opportunities for cellular life to develop spontaneously. And so therefore he says at one point, well, the origin of the first cell is a 1 in a billion probability. But guess what? We've got a billion, billion planets. So therefore it's not that improbable. But let me ask you this. If he had said the origin of the first cell is a 1 trillion to 1 probability, would that have changed anything? He just chose billion randomly. And then he said there's a billion billion stars, also randomly. We have no evidence for this. We don't know the probability of that first cell beginning. And day by day, PhD thesis by PhD thesis, we discover how incredibly complex even the basic cell is. The likelihood is if it's a 1 billion to 1 probability today, next week, it'll be a 1 trillion to 1 probability. And if it's a 1 trillion to 1 probability, then we don't have enough planets. The fact of the matter is, these are just figures that are just grabbed. And it could equally be that this is highly, highly improbable, even given the existence of billions of planets. But the point I'm simply making here is he recognizes that that's highly improbable. He even says that this move, you know, from monkey, I won't draw monkey, but to man with consciousness, human consciousness, he also says, may also be an improbable event that happened on the same scale as the origin of the first cell. But of course we have hundreds of thousands of beings, hominids, and so one of them happened to develop consciousness. Somewhat unlikely, but it happened. Here is where he really gets going, because here we have, from the first cell to the first hominid, we have the evolution, you know, of life, all right? Now there, he says, now this also seems very unlikely, that from a bacteria, you know, to a hominid just happened. Very unlikely, but no. Evolution, and this is where evolution does work. Evolution has shown that, in fact, the natural laws out there, the mechanisms, will squeeze upward and move upward a more and more complex organism. And so what seems highly improbable, like a little man, what seems improbable to leap from basic organism to hominid, massive leap, seems impossible. Actually, it's not that difficult, because while on this side of it, on the face of this cliff, seems a massive leap, actually, we know that evolution provides us steps. And this is his argument in Climbing Mount Improbable. That evolution reduces the improbability of the origin of species. And he uses this example. You've got a little man here. He's got to jump a huge cliff. Impossible. I can't climb that mountain. Too improbable. But you break it down into little steps, and then he can hop along happily and gets to the top. And this is what evolution does. He says evolution is like a crane, you see. Evolution is a crane. It can lift you up. It's a mechanism for lifting things up. What's wrong with that argument? Very, very briefly, first of all, look at the size of this man relative to that leap. Massive leap. But how do you know that the man is that size and that's how high that wall is? Again, it's like the billion to one chance of the cell. It's a guess. Maybe these steps, maybe that man is actually so tiny that this first step appears to him as big as that. You see, we haven't really shown objectively, these are just images. We haven't really shown that that first step is any more easy to make than that huge leap. Ah, but Dawkins is quick. So he'll come back and he'll say, yes, 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 maybe that's that. Maybe we'll discover that, in fact, these leaps are so big that even that first step is bad. So what we'll do, evolution is marvelous because it works with little increments. We'll break that down into little steps. So even the smallest man can climb, right? Solve the problem. But wait, each one of these steps has to be accomplished through a blind mechanism that takes hundreds of thousands of years of spontaneous mutations that are selected for until an advantage is found and accumulated. So each one of these steps has an improbability to it. This has a massive improbability. True, this is less improbable than that. And that step is less improbable than that. But what happens when you accumulate improbabilities? One of the things you learn in statistics is what's the probability of throwing a 6 with your dice? Okay? 1 in 6. What's the probability of throwing 2 6s? 1 in 12? No. The probability of throwing 1 6 is 1 in 6. The probability of throwing another 6 is 1 in 6. Isn't the probability of throwing 2 6s in a row 1 in 12? No, you do not add probabilities, you multiply them. That's the thing. You do not add these probabilities, improbabilities, to get that same improbability. You multiply them. This makes it less probable. Because now you have all these steps you have to go through to get to the same place. And you have a limited amount of time to do it. In fact, the increasing complexity on the biochemical level of life forms shows it more and more and more clearly, and this is Behe's argument, that we are dealing with massive improbabilities here. And breaking it down into incremental steps, never mind that the fossil record, on the basis of people like Jay Gould, talks about punctuated equilibrium. We don't have steady development. We have leaps, big leaps. But even granted steady sort of marginal accumulation. These accumulations, the improbabilities multiply. But let's grant him evolution. There are many theistic evolutionists who believe in evolution. That's fine. Let's grant evolution. This is somewhat probable. He has still told us the Big Bang, very improbable. He's told us fine-tuning, very improbable. The first cell, very improbable. Consciousness, very improbable. Evolution, okay, we've got that worked out. That's reasonably probable. All of these probabilities have to be multiplied against each other because they followed each other. You don't just add all these improbabilities, you multiply them. What is the probability then from here to here entirely on a natural explanation. Massively improbable. Now he will still come back and say, oh, right, Jock, massively improbable, but God is still more improbable. On what basis? We can assess probabilities here because we know the conditions. We know nothing of the conditions for God. God could be very, very likely. In fact, I would say a being who creates versus there not being a being who creates, given a creation, is in fact rather probable. I do not think there is anything new in the new atheist arguments. I do not think there's anything that we need to feel intimidated by on an intellectual level. I think these arguments can be made. They can be responded to. We're not talking about making slam dunk proofs that there is a God. But the idea that somehow it's almost certainly no God and that this has somehow been proved on the basis of evolutionary theory or the basis of philosophical argument, I think is a big, big stretch. I wish I had time to sort of really get into the nuts and bolts of this, but I wanted to give you a sense that we can stand up against the intellectual side of Dawkins. The harder side is the rhetoric. The harder side is the rhetorical kind of arguments, which are also persuaded on a more populist, more of a populist level. I want to finish by one word about where's the new atheism going. I think that it could simply be a fad. Alistair McGrath has a sort of vested interest in making sure it doesn't go very far because he predicted the end of atheism. So he is attacking Dawkins hand over fist. He's publishing books and he's written some great things. And his latest book's just come out saying it's all just a fad, it's going to go away. In America, they're taking it much more seriously. And in fact, a number of people, I've got a couple of books here that are useful responses. God is Great, God is Good, which is a collection of essays. And then this book by Moeller is an interesting kind of overview of the discussion, Atheism Remix. But they really feel this is kind of serious. Now, we have more to lose in America because we have 95% of Americans believe in God. Here in Europe, you only have 5% of people who bother to show up in church of any kind. So in a sense, you have little to lose, and so I don't think there's as much worry. But in the States, they are worried about the impact, and particularly the publicity that this is getting and the kind of rhetoric, and so they're trying to really rebut it. I think that I've been somewhat wrong in myself seeing Dawkins as a mere remnant. And I think that there is a strong likelihood that this could become something that would fill the vacuum of postmodernism. Three things will affect it. The continued postmodern mindset. How long can we continue to be pluralistically tolerant in our mindset? That's deeply inculcated into us, both because of our Christian sensibilities and our heritage, plus our postmodern sort of politically correct notions. But if we were to shift from that, and there are signs that we are, to a less tolerant sensibility, that could affect the future of the new atheism. Secondly, the rise or decline of radical Islam. The war on terror seems to be going good, well. Islam has the opportunity now with the Arab Spring to divide between a radical vision of the future of the faith and a moderate vision of the future of the Islamic faith. If the Wahhabists, if the terrorists strike again in a big way, if the war on terror goes on and on, if it gets more and more polarized, if it looks like radical Islam, and in Europe I know there's a lot of fears and a lot of sensitivities about this. If it looks like it's inevitably on the rise, that will lend strength to the new atheism. But if everything quietens down with Islamic extremism, there'll be less impetus. Finally, the next US elections. If a card-carrying evangelical is elected in the United States, no matter how fine a president they make, it will further inflame the fears of many, many secularists who are worried about the rise and influence of American evangelicalism. So I'm not going to flag what I think will happen or what should happen. But I think if those things line up in a certain way, this will be a fad that will disappear. But if they line up in a different way, this may gain currency and should be of great worry to us, because if it gains currency, it will gain political power. And if it gains political power, it will be used against people of faith. I'm absolutely clear that that will happen. It's happened in the past. There's every intimation that's already groups, powerful groups, they would like to see radical Christians behind bars. So, and that seems an extreme statement. I don't mean to just be fear-mongering. I think the good chances will all go away and tolerance will prevail. But when people are throwing bombs around, tolerance can sometimes be hard to find. So sorry I didn't leave any time. I'm sorry, Pete. He's looking at me very disappointed. But we will take some discussion next session, okay?